All right. Hello, everyone. I forgot to pick out a song so we don't have any music. Well, I was listening to Anne and totally just wasn't thinking about those kinds of things. So we're just going to go ahead and just jump right into the Tao Te Ching. This will be my third week with verse 15. And I think I've been primarily using the Wayne Dyer version for this, but we're going to look at the others because they each had lines that the others didn't have. So the only way to really look at what everybody, at least of the three translations I have, what everybody was really sharing is to go ahead and look at all three of them. But I'll start with Wayne Dyer. We'll finish up with Wayne Dyer first, and then we'll go look at the others. Let me read the 15th verse to you. The ancient masters were profound and subtle. Their wisdom was unfathomable. There is no way to describe it. One can only describe them vaguely by their appearance. And so that, of course, is what the rest of the verse is doing then, is it's attempting to point at their wisdom by describing their appearance, the ancient masters. Watchful, this is how they appeared. Watchful, like men crossing a winter stream. Alert, like men aware of danger. Simple as uncarved wood. Hollow, like caves, yielding like ice about to melt, amorphous like muddy water, but the muddiest water clears as it is stilled, and out of that stillness life arises. He who keeps the Tao does not want to be full, but precisely because he is never full, he can remain like a hidden sprout and does not rush to early ripening. So I think the only one here in the Wayne Dyer version that we haven't looked at yet is amorphous like muddy water. So amorphous means without a clearly defined shape or form. It can also mean vague, lacking a clear structure. Some of the synonyms are shapeless, formless, structureless, indeterminate, vague, nebulous, and indefinite. I think it's interesting that this would say amorphous like muddy water. And the reason I say that is because muddy water is less vague than clear water, right? So I think it's interesting that it says muddy water. I'm going to go ahead and peek at the others. Now Stephen Mitchell does not say muddy water. He says clear as a glass of water. Derek Lynn says opaque like muddy water. And he has a footnote. He says being opaque means these masters never put themselves on display despite their spiritual refinements. They had no interest in showing off their brilliance. The image of muddy water, he's referring to the next line, but I'll go ahead and read what he says. The image of muddy water becoming clear refers to the gradual revelation of the master's inner qualities. The masters had tremendous depth, so it would take time for people to really know them. It We have lots of coming and going here today. So if I seem distracted every now and then, I'm kind of looking to see who it is. But I'd love to talk to this guy, but unfortunately he had to arrive just as I was teaching. Mitigation is happening here today. So there's lots of people coming and going, but I wanted to talk to him, but hopefully I can catch him afterwards. Before I read what Derek Lynn had written as a footnote, when I was reading amorphous, indefinite, you know, he said that it meant that the masters never put themselves on display. They had no interest in showing off their brilliance. And I don't doubt that at all. But that isn't the interpretation that was coming to me. So let me share the interpretation that was coming to me. The interpretation that was coming to me was, again, around emptiness, that... A master doesn't know what she's going to say next. A master doesn't know what she's going to do next. A master doesn't know how she's going to respond. You know, a person who's attached to ego may say, for example, you know, let me make up a story. You know, if those mitigation people don't put that pile over there where I want them to, I'm just going to go up to town hall and I'm going to, you know, like, you know, we're determined. We know what we think. We know what we want. We know what we're going to do, or at least we imagine that we do. And none of that exists in the master. The master doesn't know in advance of their response how they're going to respond, or in advance of what they're saying, of what they're going to say. And so in that way, they are amorphous, right? They're indistinct. They are without shape. But that leaves the mystery of the muddy water. Ah, no, it doesn't. Don't you just love God? You ask a question, you get an answer. And I asked a question within. So what the heck does the muddy water mean? And the answer came instantly. The muddy water in this particular instance means that you can't see it. And what that means is, you know, like if I think I know someone really well, you know, I might say, well, you know, if he does this, here's how she's going to respond. You know, I think I see her. I know her ego. I know how she responds to stuff like that. And with the master, that is just not true. If you are around a true master for any length of time and you get to know them well, what you will learn is you can't predict them, right? They're like muddy water. You can't predict them. And the reason you can't predict them is because there isn't a person there, right? There's a spontaneous moment unfolding there. And you can't predict that, just like you can't predict a breeze and where it's going to blow. You know, you can't predict that. So that's what the muddy water refers to here. They're amorphous like the muddy water. They're empty. They're moved by the moment. They are the moment. They're nothing more than the moment. They can't predict their behavior. You can't predict their behavior. No sense in trying to. Let's go ahead and look and see, you know, so we've looked at watchful, like men crossing a winter stream, alert, like men aware of danger, simple as uncarved wood, hollow like caves, yielding like ice about to melt, and amorphous like muddy water. Let's look and see if there's any others here we haven't looked at. I'm looking at Stephen Mitchell. We did look at a couple weeks ago, courteous as a guest. He says shapeable as a block of wood. We looked at the block of wood. He says clear as a glass of water. So he interpreted it. He interpreted the Chinese characters differently, assuming he looked at the Chinese characters and not just lots of translations. So So what he has written is different, and it has a different meaning. Clear as a glass of water would refer to their minds. There's nothing in their minds that is interpreting, therefore there's nothing in their minds that is misinterpreting. Right? They are completely clear, completely open in their perception. Empty is another word that comes to mind. Empty in their perception, not judgmental and closed in their perception. When one is genuinely clear, one knows that all is well. Everything's all right. What's happening is what's happening because that's what needs to happen now. And, you know, that's very difficult sometimes for people to understand, you know, especially like this week we had this Sri Lankan bombing, actually multiple simultaneous bombings. And last I heard, there were around 320 people dead. Whether that's gone up or not, I don't know. And to look at that and to say all is well, you know, can almost sound uncaring, detached in an emotionally ill way, rather than an emotionally healthy way. I would say that a true master would have utmost compassion for a scene like that, utmost compassion for all of the suffering it causes, and would not see the victim's family or the perpetrators any differently. It'd be no difference in the way those individuals are seen. They're all seen as believing. They're all seen as believing. They're all seen as suffering. And so there's compassion for all of them. But at the exact same time, the master understands what's in the mind of consciousness. And the master understands that what's in the mind of consciousness has to become manifest in some way. And so in that way, it is what it has to be. You know, you can't have images that are different from the ideas that are harbored in the mind of consciousness. And from what I understand, the primary idea in this particular scene was vengeance, right? And we see vengeance everywhere. I mean, vengeance happens all the time. You know, in cities, you know, like Chicago, you know, vengeance happens pretty much every night on the streets of Chicago. Doesn't always make the national news because it's so common. In families, vengeance happens sometimes in much smaller ways. You know, you said something to annoy me, so now I'm going to do something to annoy you. You know, vengeance is pretty big in the mind of consciousness. And so the fact that it would have kind of accumulated in a spot and popped in the way that it did is not surprising. And what the master sees in that is the need for all ideas of vengeance to be released, to be let go, to be non-believed in, to be not given attention, to be acknowledged and then ignored. So there's a lot of ways that clarity sees that the average human doesn't see. And as the result, it seems to create what I would call different emotional responses. You know, the emotion of compassion and understanding and love, is very different from the emotion of anger, hatred. I don't know, what's the religious word for racism? You know, it's not like racism, it's religion against religion here. There must be a similar word, but I don't know what it is. But, you know, those ideas that the Christians hate the Muslims hate the Christians, whatever you would call that. You know, all of that is lack of clarity. Compassion, love, understanding is clarity. So the master sees the world through clarity, clear as a glass of water. The other thing that that Stephen Mitchell has written is receptive as a valley. Receptive is a valley. You know, when I contemplate the word receptive with the word valley, a valley lays wide open and it just accepts the rain. It accepts the sunshine. It accepts the wind on a windy day. And a valley never closes. Right? A valley never closes. A valley lays completely open and completely receptive. You know, if somebody decides to hold a soccer match in the valley, it accepts that. If two lovers decide to make love in the valley, it accepts that. So when he says that masters are receptive as a valley, that would mean that they are open to everything. Anne was talking about the dyad retreats last week. And one of the questions they taught people to ask themselves while in a dyad, you know, if something came up, especially something that maybe felt negative to them, the question would be, can I open to this? Right? Well, the master is naturally open to whatever occurs. The master never closes. They're as receptive as a valley. Just imagine a valley completely open. Whatever weather is happening, whatever is happening in the valley, right? It never closes. The valley never closes up and says, not that. And so the master is just as receptive as the valley. So, I think we've talked about everything that Stephen Mitchell has written, but let's just review it and then we'll go to Derek Lynn. He says, they were careful as someone crossing an iced over stream, alert as a warrior in enemy territory, courteous as a guest, fluid as melting ice, shapeable as a block of wood, receptive as a valley, clear as a glass of water. And Derek Lynn says, hesitant, like crossing a wintry river. This one I remember kind of laughing at. I said it must be a story. Cautious, like fearing four neighbors. Solemn, like a guest. Loose, like ice about to melt. Genuine, like plain wood, that would be the uncarved wood. Open like a valley and opaque like muddy water. So I think we've fully covered that portion of the verse. So let's move on to the next paragraph. Now the next paragraph in the Wayne Dyer version says, but the muddiest water clears as it is stilled, and out of that stillness life arises. Let me read Stephen Mitchell next. Stephen Mitchell says, do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself? And then Derek Lynn says, who can be muddled yet desist? In stillness, gradually become clear. Who can be serene yet persist? In motion, gradually come alive. So it's interesting, I'll just make this comment, because the previous verse talked about muddy water, and this verse kind of talks about muddy water too. But the meaning of the muddy water appears different. In the previous verse, the muddy water was a sign that, again, you couldn't quite see the master. You couldn't quite see what they're going to do. You couldn't quite, you know, you can't quite see them. Because there's not a person there. There's not a person there for you to predict. In this verse, the muddy water now seems to be about you rather than about the master. It feels like we're not looking at the master anymore. We're now looking at ourselves. And our muddy water is, for lack of better words, what I'm going to call our lack of clarity, our fullness instead of emptiness, our believing the mind instead of being free and open and receptive. It's kind of everything that makes us appear to be unlike the master. That's our muddiness. And what this verse seems to be saying is basically, are you going to run around on your ego conditioning, doing whatever your ego conditioning tells you to do? Or are you going to sit back and practice what we call rest, accept, and trust, and do nothing until that ego conditioning dies, fades, goes away? I love the way Stephen Mitchell said it. He said, do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself? In my experience of people on the spiritual path, a place where most people, and pardon the word, fail, a place where most people fail is when the conditioning activates in a very strong way, whether it's strong anger, strong fear, strong anything, strong jealousy, strong need to control. When the conditioning activates in a very strong way, they just go with the conditioning. You know, they can be on the spiritual path. They can understand all of these concepts. They can contemplate and write about these concepts. They can teach in the sanctuary and teach these concepts. But when they really get triggered, they just go with the emotions. They just go with whatever the thoughts are saying. And as a result, what they do is they miss an opportunity to heal, to heal that conditioning, to become free of that conditioning. The most important time to do nothing at all. Don't call anybody. Don't get up and change things. Don't do anything at all is when your emotions are going through the roof. That's a wonderful, 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 wonderful time to go in your bedroom, close the door, lay on the bed, and simply practice rest, accept, and trust. Do nothing. If you can do nothing and just let that pass through, you will heal. If you act on it, you will not. And that's just the simple truth. And again, the reason most people fail here is because the emotions are so strong. People have a tendency to believe emotions even more than thoughts. They think their emotions are facts. If I feel guilty, I must be guilty. If I'm afraid, there must be something to fear. If I feel wronged, I must have been wronged, right? If I feel ashamed, I must be shameful, right? And that's not true. Emotions do not express reality, and emotions do not express your truth. Emotions are lies. So when you believe your emotions to be speaking truth, you are believing a lie. And this is why it is so important to do nothing when the emotions are really strong. And in fact, on a genuine path of healing, I promise you, they will become strong in a very exaggerated way. The reason for that is the average person who is not on a path of healing is doing everything they can to repress those emotions, whether they know it or not. And when you repress those emotions, sure, you still feel them, but it's kind of like you're only feeling the top of the iceberg because you're stuffing the rest of it down. When you're on a path of healing and you start learning not to repress, that iceberg comes floating right up in your awareness, which means you may have thought you knew what guilt was before. Now you feel guiltier than you ever imagined you could. You may have thought you felt somewhat unworthy before, you know, less than other people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you never realized what a scum you thought you were until now. And you may have felt some worry and some anxiety, but you never felt fear so strong that you thought the fear itself would kill you. And that will happen on the spiritual path if you're doing it right. If you're doing it right, your emotions will at some point become more extreme, not less. And the reason is that iceberg that you have stuffed down is rising up in order to be seen by the sunshine of awareness and melt. It can't melt while it's stuffed down inside. So do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? That's the question. And one thing that I had to learn, because I went through all of this, I'm not describing anything that I personally did not go through. There's that guy again I want to talk to. Don't leave. I'm sending him telepathy messages. Don't go anywhere. I don't know if he's hearing me because he's getting closer and closer to his truck. One of the things that I had to learn is that emotions did not actually affect me. They were just energy. They were just feelings moving through the body. Because there is this crazy idea, especially with fear. There's this crazy idea, and I say crazy because at some point you see it's not at all rational. There's this crazy idea that if I let that fear get big enough and I don't do something to control it, the fear is going to kill me. And that's not true. So it's really helpful to learn to set back when you're feeling a lot of guilt or a lot of unworthiness or a lot of fear or a lot of anger or a lot of hatred. These, in my experience, are the big ones. It's really helpful to set back, close your eyes, and literally look at these things like you've never looked at anger before, you've never looked at fear before, you've never looked at guilt before, and notice that they're just feelings. That you're still breathing, your heart's still beating, you can still wiggle your toes. You know, that you're okay, even physically. You know, I mean, ultimately, it's the spirit that is unaffected. But at this point, you even want to notice that physically, even the human, Even your human beingness is unaffected by these emotions. And if you cannot notice that, at least in my humble experience, you will not be able to allow yourself to go through the intensity at which they will grow, because at some point you will believe that in some way, you know, like this unconscious belief that you have to protect yourself from these feelings, and you'll do something to stuff it. So you need to learn they can't hurt you, not even you, the person, right? They're not doing anything to you. You can, you know, still chew and swallow food. You know, you still breathe. You might not be able to sleep. I will admit that. But you'll survive that. Eventually sleep will come again. Yeah. So do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself, instead of running off and doing whatever action your mind is telling you so that you don't look so bad in front of others, or so that you can remove this fear or whatever, right? And so what Wayne Dyer says is, but the muddiest water clears as it is stilled. And out of that stillness, life arises. My experience, again, what happened for me as I allowed these things to arise is really two things happened. One is there were beliefs that died in me. And when I say a belief died, what I literally mean is, they're leaving. I'll have to catch them another time. Unfortunately, I don't know his name, so it's kind of hard running around town asking for a guy when you don't know his name. But I'll see him again. When I say that a belief clears, what I mean is you don't see it again anywhere. For example, some of the ideas that have died in me are the ideas of betrayal, the idea of rejection, the idea of guilt, the idea of unworthiness. And what happens to me is I don't see these ideas anywhere. And so, for example, I'll be sitting around with some people, and let's say something went wrong at the retreat house, something unintended and really kind of undesired, like, I don't know. It's hard for me to make up stories. You know, somebody started a fire, right? I mean, it's not something that we desired and it happened, but it's not something that we desire. So somebody starts a fire. Well, what might happen in a meeting after that, after the fire is safely out and all that, and we're talking about it, is, you know, somebody may say, well, you know, we have a rule here, no candles. And so-and-so did not follow those rules, and she had candles in there. But what you can hear in the way they're describing it is she's guilty. You can hear it in the energy. She's guilty. She broke our rules. And it's interesting because I can say the same thing. I can say, well, you know, Cindy, we have a rule here, no candles, and Cindy had candles in there, and there's no guilt in it. It's just stating this is what happened. You know, we need to be more careful in the future to make sure that we don't have candles in the retreat house because it can start fires. And there's a definite difference between the guilt, the belief in guilt, and the ability to see the mistake and talk about the mistake in an intellectual way without the guilt, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with learning from mistakes and improving processes. That's what humans do. You know, I can see couples break up, and I can see that it was just time for that couple to break up, and yet they'll both have a story about how the other rejected them. And I know that the rejection stories aren't true. It was just time for these guys to go their separate ways now, you know? So what happens when an idea is cleared from your mind, when an idea is healed, is you do not fall for those stories. I mean, you just can't. You can't believe in guilt when you don't believe in guilt. Just like I was talking about the Sri Lankan, you know, I'm sure a lot of people see the people who carried out that attack as guilty. I can only see them as confused. And I also know they're not the only ones that are confused. You know, they're not even singled out as confused, right? It's not even that. There's a lot of confusion in the world. So one thing that happens when you allow these icebergs of emotions to come up is that eventually the belief that supported the iceberg dies. And when the belief that supports the iceberg dies, you don't see it anywhere. You don't see it in yourself. You don't see it in others. It no longer exists for you. You can still be aware that others believe it, right? But for you, it's just an idea that people believe in. There's no truth to it. You know, to other people, there's truth to guilt. There's truth to unworthiness. You know, there's truth to rejection. There's truth to betrayal. That's not how I see. Just ideas that people believe in, and there's no truth to them, and there never has been. I just used to accidentally believe in them too. The other thing that happens when you do this is you start to realize, I told you that in order to allow these strong emotions to come up, you have to notice that you're okay. Even the human is okay, right? You're still breathing. You can still wiggle your toes. You know, everything's fine. It really is fine. But what happens by allowing this stuff to come up is you start to get a genuine sense of the spirit or the awareness that you really are, that's truly untouchable. You know, the more of this stuff that clears, the more you get a glimpse of or a realization of your formless self that could never, ever be touched by anything. So you get a clear realization of self by allowing these emotions to arise and clear away. One thing that's important when you're allowing these emotions to arise and clear away is, you know, I mentioned like go to your bedroom, close the door, lay on the bed. That's the way I used to do it. You must, to the best of your ability, and I will tell you, I've never been perfect at this, so obviously perfection is not a requirement, okay? You must, to the best of your ability, not believe the stories that are running through your mind at the time. I remember what I think was my last, I used to call these ego attacks. My last ego attack. It sounds stupid now, but it was just as serious as any other ego attack, even though it sounds stupid. Because we are kind of stupid at some point. But this attack came because of my house in Pueblo. I bought this house with this beautiful lawn. And the gophers moved in and began to tear up the lawn. And I tried a number of ways of getting rid of the gophers, some of which people would say were not at all spiritual, included things like putting poison down there, blowing them up, you know, a guy coming in and blowing them up. I don't remember what all we tried, but no matter what we tried, nothing worked. There were enough gophers that even though we may have killed a few, others just multiplied and life went on and they were tearing up my yard. And it's funny because the fear got very strong. The fear was a fear of, well, some of the thoughts that I remember are things like nobody will ever buy this house. You know, like I'll never be able to sell this house again. It's hard for me to remember all of the thoughts, but it was an irrational fear that somehow these gophers were making me unsafe. And there was still some guilt in it too, because there was also a guilt of, you know, of trying to get rid of them, even though I was, you know, so it's just kind of like being torn between the guilt about trying to get rid of them and the fear if I can't, which is really a horrible place to be, torn between two things like that. It's kind of a, you know, a danged if you do and a danged if you don't, right? But I remember laying in bed with this horrible fear, because again, this stuff gets exaggerated. Horrible fear coming up. And I could hear the right mind telling me to rest, accept, and trust, you know? Just breathe. I would often hear, just breathe, rest. Do not place your attention on the story, right? I could hear all of this. And then all of a sudden, my awareness shifted. So that I was the observer back behind all of it. And I not only saw the wrong mind and it's freaking out, but I saw the right mind and it's coaching. And I realized I was beyond the whole thing. I was no longer the one being coached. I was behind the right mind. It's amazing the shifts that can occur by just allowing these motions and not believing these thoughts and allowing divine nature to take its course, right? If I had just violently ran around, oh, I just remembered another ego attack. That wasn't my last ego attack. I just remembered another one. If I had gone violently running around, you know, whatever my mind was telling me to do that day, that shift never would have occurred. Yeah, so now what I think my last ego attack is, if I'm remembering correctly, there was one more beyond that one a few years later. And I may have told you this story before. I had a broken arm. And within a period of 24 hours, two different people, it's actually a broken wrist, two different people looked at my cast and commented that it was too tight. And a cast that is too tight can cut off your blood circulation and kill you. So it's not a minor thing if your cast is too tight. And two different people told me my cast was too tight within a 24-hour period. And this fear started to arise that I was going to die. And this is a pretty serious thing too. It's a pretty confusing thing because, you know, as a spiritual student, you know, rest, accept, and trust. But what if you rest, accept, and trust, and you don't do what your mind says, which is to go to urgent care and get your cast checked, and as a result, you die? It's a pretty confusing state to be in. And I wanted to heal so bad. And at the same thing time, I didn't want to be stupid and die. So I remember, first of all, I did not go to urgent care. But Danielle is a nurse. And without telling her what my fear was, without telling her that I was afraid that my cast was too tight and that I was going to die, I remember she was at my house and she was standing on one side of the breakfast bar and I was on the other side of the breakfast bar and I laid my cast on the breakfast bar so that she could clearly see it and just left it laying there while I was talking to her about whatever we were talking about with trust in my mind that if my cast was genuinely too tight, as a nurse, she would notice it and she would tell me. And if she said something, I should go to urgent care. And if she didn't say anything, I should not. She didn't say anything. So I didn't go to urgent care. And the next morning I woke up, so I guess I was fine. You know, when I went to bed, I was like, boy, I hope I wake up in the morning. And the next day I woke up, so it was fine. But it can get very confusing sometimes. That's why I say perfection is not required. You know, it can get very confusing sometimes in the middle of an ego attack. What's wise here? Like, I didn't want to die, but I also didn't want to feed that ego attack, you know? So it can get very confusing. And all I can say is when things like that begin to happen, just do your best. Keep your purpose of healing in mind, but also realize you want to be wisely guided if it seems like a dangerous situation, right? And if I hadn't had a nurse around, I don't know, maybe I would have had to just, I don't know what I've done. I'm not going to make up a story. I don't know what I would have done. I had a nurse around, so that's what happened. But all you can do is your best. What you want to make sure of is that you're not throwing your total self into the panic. If you have to go to urgent care because you're not sure, you want to remember you're going to urgent care because you're not sure, and you want to remember that you don't know, right? Rather than throwing yourself into the panic, oh my God, I'm dying. You know what I mean? In some way, you got to find whatever balance you can find and then trust that. Another funny story. I think this was probably my first, not one of my first, my first really big ego attack, but I had others before. But this one was the first one that was really extreme. I was staying at a friend's house. And there was a guy there who later, by the way, did become a stalker. He stalked this one, me, for a few years. Some of you may have heard of my stalker. And he was there, and the feeling of something's not right here, you know, was beginning to arise, but it hadn't developed yet into him being a stalker. But, you know, there was just this something's not right here with him and the way he was giving me attention. And then there was this other person there that seemed to have let go and disassociated from the world, but not in the let go and disassociate in the way that is enlightenment. He let go and disassociate in the way that is considered, you know, like you should go to a psychiatrist. You know, disassociation is considered a defense mechanism to the extreme in the wrong direction. And you should go to a psychiatrist and get help being realistic rather than unrealistic, right? So there was another guy there that had done this, that had just disassociated to the extreme. And I had known him, you know, just a few weeks earlier, and he was fine. So this change in him was alarming. And then again, there was this other person here that was on the edge of becoming my stalker, even though I didn't know that yet. That energy was alarming, right? So there were some things going on that were uncomfortable. And maybe because of these energies being around me and me giving enough attention to them, I'm sure, something went off in my head that I was in danger in this house, that I was in danger. And I remember I was laying in bed at night, and I could hear this pounding coming from the basement. Like all night long. And I'm up on the second floor of the house, and I can hear this pounding from the basement. And my mind starts saying, oh my God, there's somebody down there. They've got somebody locked up down there in the basement. They won't let them out. I mean, I just knew it, and I didn't know what to do. I mean, everything in this house felt weird, and now there's somebody locked up in the basement. And I was, my feeling of unsafe was getting just, you know, huge. And I just chose to the best of my ability. Now, you got to remember, I didn't know for a fact whether I was in an unsafe house or not. You got to remember this. So I just kept feeling to the best of my ability for intuition, and the intuition was just to practice rest, accept, and trust. So I practiced rest, accept, and trust. And the next morning when I went down to breakfast, I mean, I felt like I had a hangover. I call it a fear hangover. I really felt like I had a hangover. I went down there half dead, exhausted from the fear, headache, and heard somebody say something like, did you hear Buddha, you know, beating against that door all night last night? And somebody else commented, I don't remember exactly what they said, but they commented so that I understood that Buddha was a dog and that Buddha was vicious and would bite guests, and they had to keep Buddha in the basement because there were guests in the house, and it was Buddha. beaten on the door somehow all night long. It was a dog. I guess the only reason I'm telling this story is because I want people to understand how the mind can outrageously exaggerate something that it picks up, like with the senses. When you're going through these phases of this stuff coming up to be healed. And I want people to understand you genuinely do not know for sure. You can't say 100% for sure, this is just emotion and I'm safe. And so it takes a lot of courage. Oh, there was even a time when someone had their hands around my throat and was considering strangling me. I mean, there were all kinds of things that have come up as I've gone along this path that have pushed this fear up. And and I never wanted to be foolish. I never wanted to be stupid, and yet I wanted to heal. And so all I could do was pay attention to intuition to the best of my ability. I really think the intention is very important. That when the person had their hands around my neck, I was actually asleep, and this person came in and had their hands around my neck, and of course that woke me up. But when it woke me up, I didn't open my eyes. I just became alert. And the guidance was just to remain still. And the person apparently considered what they were thinking of doing and then decided not to. But I often wonder what would have happened if I hadn't trusted that guidance and I hadn't remained still. You know, what if I had opened my eyes and tried to fight, and the person, the person might have then put pressure, right? Now, hopefully none of these things will ever happen to you, but they did happen to me. And there's more stories. You know, because like I said, the guy did turn into a stalker. That did happen. And there was a lot of fear around that. Can you remain unmoving till right action arises by itself? That's the part that's saying you really have to be feeling for your best intuition in the moment. Your intention needs to be with intuition and not with the fear. And again, you're not going to know if you're doing a perfect job. How could you know? You're just doing your best. Eventually, the clarity comes, the clarity that they talked about, clear as a glass of water, where you're able to recognize situations for what they are, and there isn't this exaggerated fear, right? But the exaggerated fear is there because fear has been repressed, imagination is still believed, and until these things are healed, I know people who, and of course this is not fear, well it is fear deep down, but it doesn't feel like the emotion of fear. I know people who imagine their spouses having affairs all the time when it's just the furthest thing from the truth. You know? People who imagine their children in all kinds of dangerous situations if they're half an hour late getting home, which is just the furthest situation from the truth. The child's just, you know, having fun. And child, I mean college age kids, right, or teenagers. But if we believe our imagination, it can really take us into deep, dark places. And until we learn not to believe our imagination, we will probably find ourselves in some deep, dark places needing to decide, am I going to believe my imagination again today? Or am I going to start seeking out intuition? And that's the decision we have to make. And again, things can go wrong and we may need to go to urgent care. And so I also don't want to encourage anyone to be foolish, right? It's a matter of attempting to be as wise as possible, even while there's a panic going on, instead of just listening to the panic. And we still haven't finished 15. It's taken forever to get through 15, but that's all right. So do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself? But the muddiest water clears as it is stilled. And out of that stillness, life arises. Clarity about who you are. And then Derek Lynn says, and his is enough different that I don't know if we can just summarize his, who can be muddled yet desist in stillness gradually become clear. So yeah, who can be muddled yet desist, not run around listening to the panic is what he's talking about. Who can do that? And then in stillness gradually become clear. Who can be muddled yet desist in stillness gradually become clear? Who can be serene yet persist, right? So persist in the rest, accept and trust. Oh no, let me read the rest of this. Who can be serene yet persist in motion, gradually come alive? So here he's talking about following only the right mind, being serene and persisting in being serene, and then being moved by the right mind. Who can be muddled yet desist in stillness, gradually become clear, desist from listening to the wrong mind? Who can be serene yet persist in motion, gradually become alive, persist in listening to the right mind. So there is still one more paragraph to chapter 15. And I'm sure it's simple, and maybe we'll also get 16 next week. But for now, I'll type in lesson 15, part 3, and put a title in just a moment.